We're joined on the telephone right now by Rick Allen, and Rick Allen is an engraver and printmaker down at Ken Speckle Letter Press down in Duluth. Rick, welcome to the Roadhouse.
Thanks very much, Buck. It's awfully nice to be here.
Good to have you on the radio. It'd be even more fun if you were in the studio, but this is pretty good. You're going to be in town tomorrow night, and that's going to be, or actually tomorrow day, tomorrow from 1 to 4 at Severson's Gallery?
That's right.
And this is not your first stopover at Severson's. I know you were there, I think, last summer. You had a talk there as well?
Well, I think it was
the summer before.
At last winter.
Oh, okay.
Although winter can seem like summer or vice versa, depending on...
For me, it could be any time. You know, I've reached that age, so...
Well, like Mark Twain said, you reach an age where you only remember those things that never happened.
That's pretty good. Rick, the first question I'm going to ask is, Ken Speckle Letter Press, where did that come from?
Well, Ken Speckle is a Scottish word, and it's a fun one to say, and it means conspicuous or easily recognizable or distinctive. When we named it, we were looking for something that was fun for people to say and had them wondering what it could mean.
And it was distinctive?
It was well, we'd like to think, in good or bad terms, that what we do is distinctive.
Yes, and as I mentioned, you're an engraver and a printmaker and well-known throughout this area, not only for the work that you have in your studio, but also the work that you do with other people's work, particularly books, doing the artwork and books, and that's what you're going to be talking about, I believe, tomorrow is a new book out there by Joyce Sidman.
Yep, she's a well-known poet and children's author down in the Twin Cities, and she's had a number of books out with other Minnesota artists like Becky Prange up in Ely, and she has a good track record with producing good work and encouraging artists to do their best in return.
You know, her book is called The Dark Emperor and Other Poems of the Night, and as I look at some of your work, some of it is a little dark out there. You know, it fits for that genre very well, but it's a mixed bag in what you do. Some of it is like it reminds me of, I'm not even sure, monsters. Am I anywhere? Are we on the same wavelength here or something? It's kind of the dark time of day sometime in some of those, and
yeah.
when you're talking about the Dark Emperor or other creatures that are scary out there, they come alive in some of your work.
Well, Joyce has mentioned that she wrote this book because she was a little unsure about the night as any place she wanted to be. So she wanted to learn a little bit more about it.
Mm-hmm.
And her poems reflect that. And towards that end, I thought lino cuts, which are what we did for the book, were appropriate. Since you start with a flat block of material and you cut the image out of it, more or less cutting light into the block, so the material you cut away doesn't take ink, and the stuff you leave behind does take the ink and make the print. So it seems to reflect the whole nature of nocturnal printmaking imagery.
Now, that was a very good description. You know, we had Betsy Bowen on the show last week, and that was one of our questions was, you know, how do you make that work? It seems like you're working backwards.
Oh, you definitely are. I remember Tom Waits once described members of his band as coming from good families, but just gradually over time developed ways about them that just aren't right. And I think printmakers are
that's good.
Similar to that, because you have to work backwards. In the nature of it, when you do a drawing that you transfer onto a block, you have to reverse the drawing, so you're cutting out the areas that don't print, leaving the things behind that do, and you're doing it backwards. So I think it's suited for left-handers particularly.
Okay. Because most people looking at them are right-handed?
Pardon?
Is it because most of the viewing audience is right-handed?
Well, you know, after you've been making prints long enough, you're not sure what hand is up. And also, you can't be sure what other people see in it, and that's not your job anyway.
Sure.
You just hope that it evokes something for them.
Mm-hmm. I mentioned maybe a little too much some of the darker images that are out there, but you also have a part of your press work that's called, and I know I'm going to mispronounce this right away. You know, it's Gicle.
Gicle.
See, I don't know a thing about that, but that's kind of the opposite end of the spectrum. They are so bright and vivid and beautiful. Can you tell us a little bit about how that happens?
Well, along with the Scottish words, printmaking has a lot of French words, and gicle is one of them. It sounds wonderful, but really it just means ink spray.
Oh.
You know, it's like many things that you hear in French that sound wonderful, and then you find out it's a piece of plumbing. Or,
okay.
And so gicle is the method by which most photography and much fine art is reproduced now. It's a digital process that results in archival art from original art.
Now, is that how you get those vivid, amazing colors into that? Is that a computer-generated thing?
We scan the original print, which is six or seven blocks that are printed in an original edition and then hand-colored. And then for another step in printmaking, we scan it into a computer where we can play with the color if we want to, take it another step in the process, and then print it out on a gicle machine, which gives you a wonderful saturation of color and intensity, something that you can control.
Now, you work with your wife, and as Marion, and you've done that for quite some time. How does that all work? I mean, that's living and working pretty close with somebody. I think you do the mechanical part, and then she enhances it. Am I on the right track?
We do. We like to say that I'm living in the 19th century, and she's living in the 20th century or 21st century. And I suppose that means that we meet in the 20th.
Somewhere there.
I work hand tools and paper and ironmongery, a bunch of old iron presses and inks and everything that probably in essence haven't changed for millennia. And she's primarily in the digital world. And so thanks to her, these disparate centuries can sort of kiss and commingle and produce something.
How do you decide where your work is going to go as far as the product that you put out there? Has that evolved over time as to what people really want? Or maybe you can talk a little bit about that.
Well, you're giving me far too much credit to say that I decided anything or steered it anyway. It's kind of like being in a boat. There are a lot of short tacks on the way to a destination, and you might not wind up there, but someplace else altogether different. And then in that end, really, we just follow our nose. We get an idea, no matter how harebrained or implausible. It's best just to get it out of your system and put it out and see if people respond to it and wonder why they do.
So it's trial and error, more or less, is kind of what you're saying. But you do come up with your original idea, and just see where it goes.
It definitely changes over time. You might start out with a sketch and then just keep refining it. And after hours of refining it, you go back to the original sketch to find out that was the best to begin with.
Uh-huh.
And then it's a good idea not to refine the sketch over much when you put it on the block, because you don't want to just reproduce the drawing. You want to be cutting an image on the block that has some life of its own rather than just reproduction of something else.
Yeah, how often does it happen that you're halfway through work on a wooden block, and as you described, you know, you're taking things away, and it's not like you can just take an eraser out. The doorbell rings, or somebody makes a loud noise, and you make a mistake.
Well, that's one advantage that Marion and most people who work digitally have. They can revert to the last saved position.
Yeah,
and printmakers, I mean, I think that's probably the It's a low level of risk-taking, but it's still risk-taking. The more time you put into this, the more material you cut away, closer you are to completion, the scarier a mistake can become. Mm-hmm. I think that's part of the thrill of making it. You know, that old thing, they say that doctors bury their mistakes, and according to Frank Lloyd Wright, architects grow ivy on their mistakes. I don't know what printmakers do. I think we just hope nobody else than us notice any mistakes that we put in every print.
Sure. That's kind of why I don't do any work on my house. I'd know everything that was wrong. Hire somebody else, you'll never know.
Well, and two, hiring somebody who knows what they're doing hopefully removes some of the risk.
Yeah, that helps a lot, too.
So,
I want to go back to the new book that we'll be talking about tomorrow and your work on it, the artwork that's in Joyce Sidman's book. How did you decide? Now, this is a book of poetry, and it's very interpretive. How did you decide on what the artwork would be? Was it ideas of your own? Did you work with Joyce so that you'd be on the right same page? Or?
Well, that's one of the interesting things of illustrating text, whether it's a book or prose or poem, is deciding what the images are going to do. Are you going to take something exactly lifted from the book and try to illustrate a specific thing, or be somewhat looser and suggest a feeling that the prose or poetry suggests? And in this case, I had great liberty. Ann Ryder, the editor of the book, more or less the art director from Lutzen, had a wonderfully light hand and let me go far astray and wander far afield without getting too concerned or directing me too much. And Joyce also just let me have my way and come up with what the poems or the words suggested.
Mm-hmm. So there really wasn't necessary to have that much back and forth.
No, it's kind of fun to have that much liberty, and mm-hmm. It takes an act of faith on both the writer's and the editor's part. Robert Burns once said of one of his efforts, "Perhaps it might turn out a song, perhaps turn out a sermon." When you start on these things, you don't know whether it's going to sing or whether it's going to be a cautionary tale that's read in church. And that's also part of the fun, I think, is the not knowing.
We're speaking with Rick Allen, and Rick is from Ken Speckle Letter Press down in Duluth. He's an engraver and printmaker and well-known throughout this area. Rick, you didn't start out carving wood blocks. Had kind of a varied, fun career. Can you tell us a little bit? I mean, starting out running a climbing school is a little different than running that 1898 press down there.
It is, but somehow all the little rabbit trails seem to eventually go this way. I graduated from college with a degree in history, and then spent a number of years as a failed humanist. Working in bookstores, I spent a term as a legal assistant at a large law firm. Large law firms often being the last resort of failed humanists. And then with a couple of friends for a number of years, we organized and ran an ice and rock climbing school down in the Twin Cities before finally drifting back into probably the natural sluiceway of my bent, mm-hmm. which is printmaking, graphic art.
And you're still located right down by the waterfront.
We're right down in Canal Park, mm-hmm. so we hear the bridge every time it goes up and have a beautiful view, a north-facing window, looking at the hillside as it's just starting to turn color.
Now, what's that location do for your art? Is that a big help in your life to have something that interesting outside your window?
I think it is, and to be in a building which is in its own sense a small community is something I'm sure you guys can identify mm-hmm. with. Pretty soon you know everybody in the building and their foibles and what they do. So it's nice to be able to go out and mingle in a slightly larger community, and stepping out in Canal Park where the lake is right here, definitely an inspiration. I think if Marion and I were mewed up in a log cabin 6 miles inland, we probably would have chewed each other's legs off long before. But when you can take a walk around the block, see what the weather is doing. Some sailor said about Cape Horn, there are only two kinds of weather at Cape Horn, neither of them the pleasant kind. Sometimes Duluth or the North Shore can seem like that, but today, for instance, yeah. minute to minute, it's been changing, and that's certainly invigorating. invigorating and inspiring.
But what colors over the water? Even the bad weather brings.
To get that green water that's so distinctive to the lake and certain kinds of light is immensely satisfying. And yesterday we had the Northeaster piling the water up on the shore, and that's always gratifying, watching pieces of real estate float away.
You know, you mentioned earlier the Scottish language involved in your website, and also your climbing background, you know, teaching some ice climbing, and I should mention to folks that I don't know if you still do that, but for a while you were coming up here to climb Nightshade in the wintertime. Of course, that's, I think it's Nightshade on Devil's Track.
Nightfall, yes.
Nightfall, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
In your kilt.
Well, some years ago when we started ice climbing, I mean, we're talking 30 years ago, at least in northern Minnesota, nobody knew what they were doing. And state-of-the-art was literally ironmongery and wool knickers and sweaters. You were all woolly, and you had tools that were poorly designed for the purpose. And you'd go out and do this thing that nobody in their right mind would have to do. A friend once said, ice climbing is singular in its uselessness. So we did this for many years, and technology advanced, and ice climbing became a real sport, and then... Actually, it's quite some years ago now, a friend and I were saying, I wonder if we could still climb with those things that we used, you know, in the dark ages, 15 mm-hmm. years earlier. So we got kitted up in our old woolen knickers and axes and went up to Nightfall with some flasks of whiskey and poetry and hacked our way up at Nightfall. Is named Nightfall because you always finish at Nightfall. And it was so much fun, we started to do it on an annual basis. And just like barnacles, you know, things start to adhere, and it gets bigger and bigger. More and more people would come, and we started to have pipers and kilts. And one memorable occasion where a young woman climbed it and, in borrowed boots that were too big, stepped out of her boot halfway up and finished the climb with that boot and crampon tucked under her arm, giving us a whole new definition of fortitude.
There you go. Yeah, I didn't have much choice at that point, I guess.
Well, she could have tossed the boot, which would have been interesting for people down below.
Yeah.
But it certainly ranks as one of the more interesting finishes, and proof of the value of wool. Her wool stocking just stuck to the ice, and then she pulled it loose for the next step. It was a singular ascent.
Everything worked out.
Well, so far.
Yeah, so far. The other part of your website that I'm not going to pronounce was the Shai Namita.
Shai Namita, and that's new. We just launched a website this past week after having lived with our old creaky dial telephone website for 6 or 7 years. Shai Namita is an endeavor that Marion is undertaking now. She starts to produce her own giclée prints of her own imagery.
Oh, so is there a meaning to the? I mean, we talked about the other couple of words that I obviously didn't know.
Shai Namita, I think, comes from a Zen Buddhist practice, and I won't even venture to go there. That's really something
that's a Marian thing.
That's properly Marian's purview.
Okay,
I'm going to stay in the world of Ken Sparkle.
Okay. As we were talking earlier, you're going to be up here tomorrow from 1 to 4, and that's at Severson's Gallery. You're going to talk about the process of engraving, wood engraving.
We'll probably bring some samples of the blocks and prints, and for people who are interested, all two or three of them.
And everybody's welcome there.
Everyone is welcome. As we do like to say, we'll talk your ear off about printmaking until you chew your leg off to escape the trap.
Now, I'm assuming that your art can be found at Severson's?
Yeah, both in Duluth and at Grand Marais, they offer the original prints that we pull off the block, and then the giclée prints that we pull off the printer.
Now, can people find your work on the web, too? Can they buy it on the web?
They can buy it directly from us at our website at kenspeckleletterpress.com. And the site seems to be working. It was put together by a lovely web coder who lives over in Northern Ireland.
Really?
The person that we refer to as our Irish boyfriend.
Now, how did that happen?
Well, Marion came across him years ago on the road to something else, and over time he's become the go-to coder for the website projects that she works on.
Just kind of how it worked.
Just how it worked, and it's one of the marvels of the digital age. Besides letting letterpress survive as an art form or as a craft, it makes these round-the-world connections entirely feasible.
We've been speaking with Rick Allen. Rick is an engraver, wood engraver, and printmaker at Ken Speckle Letter Press, and that's down in Duluth in the Canal Park. He's going to be here tomorrow at Severson's Gallery right in downtown Grand Marais from 1 to 4. Going to talk about a new poetry book by Joyce Sidman, which Rick did all the artwork for, and you can hear about that and his work in general and his methodology tomorrow from 1 to 4. So, Rick, I want to thank you so much for joining us here tonight.
Thank you for talking with me, Buck. It's nice to catch up with you as well.
And hopefully we run into each other tomorrow while you're up this way.
Well, you know where I'll be from 1 to 4.
That's for sure.
Stop in, and I'll shake my shackles at you.